As we are aware, this is the Memorial Day weekend, and it's set aside by our nation to remember those who have given of themselves, sometimes even the ultimate sacrifice, to guarantee our freedoms and our continuance as a nation, in spite of the fact that many will use it as a time, as a few days off from work, or time to spend time with family and have barbecues or picnics or times at the lake or whatever it might be. We really need to remember the price that was paid by so many so the rest of us could enjoy these privileges and blessings. I was thinking this past week of another group of people that we ought to be thankful for as well. In all of our lives, there have been many points in time in which someone else made a difference. Hopefully for good, but I'm sure sometimes even for bad. Sometimes in our culture today, they call these things turning points or even tipping points. That's a common term in businesses right now, is tipping points. Certain events or points in time in which things changed going forward from that point in time. It might have been a person. It might have been an idea. It might have been a book. It might have been an event that changed everything. But often in our earlier lives, at least, it was people. I probably wouldn't have been a great reader of books and enjoy reading so much if it hadn't been for Miss Fanny Murchison, my second through fourth grade teacher. I went to a very small school where we had four grades in one classroom. One through four was taught by Mrs. Murchison, and grades 5 through 8 was taught by Mr. Travis. I honestly don't even know what his first name was. Didn't then and don't now. And after you finished 8th grade, then you went into town to the big school. But if it hadn't been for Mrs. Murchison, I wouldn't love to read. And when I got to the big school, if it hadn't been for Mr. Killam, I wouldn't have loved science. If it hadn't been for Mr. Ward, I wouldn't have loved math. Things that have shaped my life ever since. But that wouldn't tell the whole story, because even though my parents were not scientifically minded, and neither of them were much readers, or much when it comes to math and other things like that, when I was 5 years old, my parents became Christians. And so if it wasn't for Brother Jordan and Brother Ward and others I can't remember the names of in Sunday school class, I wouldn't know the Bible. And I wouldn't love the stories of the Scripture, and I wouldn't have committed much more than I've now forgotten of the Scriptures to memory. And when I got to college, if it hadn't been for another man at the college where I went, knocking on my door on a Saturday morning and making sure that I got picked up for church on Sunday morning, and eventually when he changed from one congregation to another, took me with him, I wouldn't have met James Wilson, who convinced me that I ought to be preaching the gospel instead of working on computers. Tipping points. People we ought to remember. All of us have such people, and you probably are thinking right now of some in your life who have made that difference. But let's not forget that we play that same role over the course of our lifetime with many people as well. We might not be school teachers. We might not even be Bible class teachers. But our children, and now for many of us, our grandchildren, we have the opportunity to say those things and do those things and help put things into their life that will influence them for the rest of their life. To help them learn to love God and to know about Him and to be conscious of how they live and be questioning whether or not the way they live will please Him when they're just little guys. And now as they grow up, hopefully to make all the difference. And we could go on and on about that. I think about the young man when I was still very early myself in preaching the gospel, and our kids were small. This moved to this congregation to preach for them, and this young man was just in high school, a junior, and his family was not very well to do, and so they lived in a house too small, just a 2-bedroom house, as I remember. But a man and his wife, he worked in the refineries there, and mom stayed home raising the kids, and there were 5 of them or 6 kids in a 2-bedroom house. So I became friends with this young man, Tony, and So after a while, just to give him a little freedom without total freedom, we talked with his mom because his dad was not a Christian, and they agreed it would be okay if since we had an extra bedroom, he moved in and lived with us. At that time, I was supplementing our income by working as a printer in the printing business. I won't tell you how I got into that, but actually owned some printing equipment and a little business in the back of the house. So while Tony was living with us and finishing up his high school, he would come back there and help me. He's gone on from that to become a great man in the church. And he has devoted his life to seeing that the gospel gets out to other people in printed form. He runs a very good size printing book company today, printing nothing but Christian books. Did I know at the time that was going to change his life and determine how he lived the rest of his life, at least up until this point? No. But I had the opportunity and I did what I could just to help him to have something to do with his life. He didn't know at that time what he wanted to do with his life. So I said, well, I can at least teach him a trade. And that has become his life and his ministry. Jesus did the same thing with those that he touched. At the very beginning of his ministry, some disciples of John were pointed by John to Jesus. And so they turned from following John and came to Jesus and says, Rabbi, where are you staying? According to John chapter 1, Jesus says, come and see. We know those fellas. Their name was Peter and John. They became two of the greatest of his disciples. When he gave his great commission just before he left the earth, he was in effect telling them and telling us, tell other people the most important thing they can know. That God loves them and He sent His Son to die for them. And if they'll respond to that by changing their lives and devoting themselves to obeying Him, they can have a hope of eternal life. He basically was telling His disciples and telling us, because we're still under the Great Commission, that we have the responsibility of being a turning point for many other people. We're in the beginning of a study of what I call the God who is there. What I've just said fits in very well with what we're talking about now, because we live in a culture in which many people are beginning to question whether there is a God there. And our children and our grandchildren and our neighbors and our friends are all influenced by this culture in which we live, in which there's this air of questioning and this air of doubt and even this public proclamation of denial that there really is a God. We have the opportunity to make the difference for so many people by what we say at the appropriate time. And it does make a difference. I found a couple of things here that really touched my thinking along this line. One of them is from a man by the name of Mortimer Adler. Haven't ever known anyone else named Mortimer before, except in the cartoons. But Dr. Mortimer Adler was a well-recognized philosopher of his generation. But more than that, he became the editor-in-chief of a volume of books that have made a great deal of difference to many people. It's called The Great Books of the Western World, a 60-volume set, a collection of what he and others who worked with him considered the very best literature that has been produced from the days of the Greeks down to our modern time. And many libraries and even many homes, at least in the previous generations, would have these books in their libraries. And he commented on the fact that as he worked to bring this set to its completion, that he was struck by the fact that almost every writer that he considered, and almost every writer that ended up being included in this set of books, not necessarily in the writings that were included in the books, but somewhere in the production, the writings of these people, every one of them felt compelled to talk about God in one way or another. And he felt like it was so important that we recognize that believing in God makes all the difference. And he said in one place, more consequences for thought and action follow the affirmation or denial of God than the answering of any other basic question. The whole tenor of human life is affected by whether men regard themselves as the supreme being in the universe or acknowledge a superhuman being whom they conceive of as an object of fear or love and a force to be defied or a lord to be obeyed. What he's saying is that if man considers himself the supreme being in the universe, they will live and act one way. But if they believe there is a supreme being to whom they must answer, then they will live a different way and they will act a different way. A number of years ago, Dr. D. James Kennedy, a very influential preacher and writer in the American Christianity, passed away just a few years ago. I've written quite a number of books, six in my mind, maybe 70 or so. But a number of years ago, back when the Merv Griffin show was still on television, he was invited to be a guest on that show one evening. And part of the topic of discussion was Mr. Griffin asking him what he thought about prayer in the schools. This was just when the Supreme Court and everything was ruling about whether that should be allowed and all the controversy regarding that and so forth. And of course, Dr. Kennedy strongly believed that prayer should be not just allowed, but should be a standard part of our public schools. Griffin didn't agree. He actually asked at one point, "What good is a couple of minutes of prayer going to do anyway? What difference does it make?" Dr. Kennedy said, and continued to say, "It makes all the difference. Not because of the 2 minutes, but because it says that this person believes there is a supreme being to whom they answer and to whom they can turn, both for guidance in life and for help. And if a person doesn't believe in such a supreme being, then they will live their lives entirely differently. And we as a nation will live out our history entirely differently if we don't believe there's a being higher than ourselves to whom we can turn and to whom we answer. That's the difference it makes." We're living in a time when we can see and observe that right now we're sort of schizophrenic as a nation, aren't we? On the one hand, we want to say, let's take God out of our culture. Let's no longer have the Ten Commandments posted in our courthouses. Let's no longer make public references to God. But then a disaster strikes. The Oklahoma bombing, 9/11. And then suddenly what happens? We hear our highest leaders, the same ones who are passing the laws and supporting the removal of God from our culture, saying, let's sing God Bless America. Let's call for a day of prayer. To whom? If we've told our people and now raised our children, at least in our public schools, to never know there is such a God, and we've refused to allow others to acknowledge those who influence them in our public schools and our public life from acknowledging there's such a supreme being, who is it they're singing to? Who is it they're praying to? I don't intend for it to be a soapbox, but I'm just saying we're at that point in our life as a nation right now. We're trying to decide, do we really want to acknowledge such a supreme being or not? Certainly our forefathers did. Those who wrote our Constitution, those who founded our nation, and those who have lived over the last 200 years, by and large, believed in such a supreme being. Now last week, as we began the series, talked about the fact, this God who is there, that He is an invisible God. Certainly those who don't believe in a supreme being, whether it's the God as we conceive of Him or any other kind of God, as far as that's concerned, those who would classify themselves either as atheists or at least agnostics, say that, yes, God's invisible because He's not real. And to believe in such an unseen being is really unscientific. Science gives us the answer. And science, they say, says there is no supreme being. They would argue that those who continue to believe in such a being are just superstitious. That we hear a sound in the darkness and we automatically attribute it to something. It's a ghost or a goblin or something like that. And that's the same way we are about this God we believe in. And they reject the whole idea that some supreme being has passed down some set of moral or ethical laws and guidelines. That in fact, our moral laws and ethics only come as sort of a consensus of the human race itself agreeing to the things that are good or bad that we should be doing. And certainly there is no such thing as sin in their view, because that certainly implies that some law has been broken that we then have to answer for to this higher power that they don't believe exists. We, on the other hand, acknowledge, as does the Bible, yes, our faith in this supreme being is a faith in someone who is invisible. We agree to that. But invisible or unseen doesn't mean unreal. One does not equate to the other, for there's many things we believe in that are unseen and yet very real. Nor do we accept the premise that believing in a supreme being is unscientific. We might well be surprised at how many very prominent scientists in the past and in the present are strong believers in an intelligent being that exists as a supreme being. The man who's widely credited, and rightly so, with finally cracking the code of the human genome, that finally unraveled in a spectacular way our understanding, or at least their understanding, I don't understand it, but their understanding of the human gene and how the chromosomes and all this work and the coding and all of that, the man who received national, international acclaim for being the one who discovered that, believes that everything that exists is a result of a supreme being who created it. And our present administration wanted to appoint him to head up the government body that represents the interface between the scientific community and the government. He was appointed to head that up. He was widely opposed by atheists, including scientists who are atheists, because they said he will bring unscientific methods into his office. That hadn't turned out to be the case. I don't think they have much to complain about the way he's done his job. But he's only one of tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of men with PhDs in the sciences who are active, who believe in a supreme being. And many of them go far beyond just believing in a supreme being, are actually Christians in the sense they believe that God sent His Son to die for their sins, and they've made a commitment to try to follow Him. So it certainly isn't true that belief in an invisible God is unscientific, in spite of the fact that one of the most prominent atheist writers right now, Richard Dawkins, says in more than one of his books that there's no credible scientist who believes in a supreme being. That's hogwash. There's probably more prominent scientists who do believe in a supreme being than believe like Mr. Dawkins does. But he doesn't wish to acknowledge that. And he thinks if he says it loud enough and long enough in a popular enough book that people will actually believe what he says instead of what the truth is. We affirm, we believe there is evidence sufficient, ample evidence even, to believe that this invisible God is there and is active and we can know of Him. And so today we move on to the thought in a few minutes, in the next few minutes, of not only is He invisible as we talked about last week, but we want to talk about the concept of seeing Him who is invisible. Now certainly we know in the Scriptures, even Jesus Himself said that no one has seen God. There is a sense in which that's true. His nature and such is that it's beyond our ability, limited by human flesh as we are, to fully see Him as He is. And yet there is this very real sense in which we do see Him who is invisible. You know, in the ancient world, in the modern as well, man tends to become like the god or the gods he worships, or else he actually makes gods in his own image that he then worships. There's a very interesting part of Jeremiah back in the Old Testament in chapter 10, verses 1 through 10, where Jeremiah talks about how some of the nations around the Israelites, that a man would go out into the forest and he'd find a fine tree and he would cut it down and he would bring it in. He would cut off the branches. He would strip off the bark. He would shape it. He would form it. He would cut on it. And then at last he would tilt it up, decorated with the jewels and the gold and the so forth that he had adorned it with. And after he had done all of that, then he would bow down before it and said, "Oh, you who made me." And in fact, It was the man who made the idol, not the idol who made the man. But in the ancient cults of Canaan, all around Israel in the Old Testament times, they often worshiped what were called fertility gods. Gods who practiced promiscuous sexual intercourse and so forth. And the ancient peoples had come to believe that somehow when the gods had their sexual relations, that this then produced the fertility of the earth. But the interesting thing is that those who worshiped these fertility gods were promiscuously active as well, in imitation of the gods they worshiped. And then those nations that had gods who were gods of war and gods of cruelty, like the Assyrians, and like those who worship Molech, who even went so far as to practice human sacrifice to their gods, they then as nations were cruel nations. They showed no regard for human life, not even the lives of their own citizens as a result. They became like their gods, or perhaps their gods were like them. The Greeks and the Romans both had their whole pantheon of gods. But when you look closely at those gods, and you don't even have to look too closely, you realize that these gods were nothing but magnified forms of human beings. They fought, they hated, they were deceitful, they lied, they stole, they tricked each other. They did just what people did. Their gods were just like them. And so as a result, the Greeks and the Romans, almost to a man or woman, didn't revere and honor these gods in the way we think of revering and honoring our God. Certainly they feared them because they believed they had control over their lives. And they prayed to them and they made sacrifices to them and they tried to appease them. But they didn't respect them. For they were no greater than themselves except in power and their imaginations. The same is true of modern gods. If the supreme being that someone worships is science, then they're going to let science dictate to them all of life. And since science can't discover ethics and morals, they're going to be convinced that ethics and morals are an invention of the human imagination, not something that's absolute and real. And if science, that they see as the supreme being, that which created everything and is the study of everything that really exists, says that there is no evidence that we have to answer to any supreme being, then they say we end up being just little cogs, little gears in a great machine that runs without any meaning or purpose to it. And it doesn't even make any sense to ask what is life all about because there is no such answer. And all we can hope to do is maybe perhaps live as comfortably as we can in this little existence we have. And maybe we can do a little something to push forward the progress of mankind, but ultimately it's all going to end in a great burnout of this universe and the collapse of the universe back in upon itself. We can't talk about life after this because there's no scientific evidence of it, they say. We become like our gods. And if science is our God, then we're going to do what our God says. But that's not how we live. And that's not how the people of the Bible live, because they ardently believed in Him who is invisible. Over in the book of Hebrews in chapter 11, I don't know if you realize it or not, but the 11th chapter of Hebrews that we often call the great chapter on faith or the great chapter of the heroes of faith is really a great chapter about believing in that which is invisible. That's really the theme of the chapter. Because the writer begins this way, Hebrews 11:1, "Now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. By faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible." And then he goes on to start detailing those people of faith of the Old Testament that we know the stories about. And the point he's making with each one is that they served someone they could not see. They believed in someone that was invisible. Abel offered a better sacrifice than Cain because he believed what the invisible one had said. Enoch walked with God and disappeared from this life without dying as he followed the invisible. Abraham, Noah. Noah spends all these years building a great ark in anticipation of a great flood and preaching to those who would listen all around him that God was going to destroy the world as they know it because of their sin. And he did all that without ever having seen God. But not only believed that he was there, but believed that God had delivered his will, his message, to Noah's generation. And that God would be faithful to what he said. And Noah, of course, was confirmed or found proof that it was true because the flood did come. And he and his family and those animals that were kept inside the ark were saved while the rest of the world they knew was destroyed. Abraham was called out of Ur of the Chaldees by a God he did not see. And no doubt by many of his neighbors was saying, "What happened, Abraham? Did you eat something that gave you indigestion last night? And that's why you thought in the middle of the night you heard voices that told you what to do?" Certainly they could have well said that. But he left his home and his homeland and his family and moved to Haran and then eventually down into the land that we now call the land of Israel. And he believed that this invisible God that he never saw had told him that this would be for him and his for his descendants, and that this God he never saw told him that he and his wife, who had never been able to have children, would have children, and that soon that he would be the father of a great nation of people, all of which came to pass. You see, it's believing in the invisible. And he gets down to talking about Moses in Hebrews 11, in verse 24. It says, "By faith Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time." He could have enjoyed all that Egypt offered because he was, in effect, the adopted son of the Pharaoh himself. But he chose not to do that. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ. And by that, the Hebrew writer means for the sake of what God had promised would come, as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead. He was looking forward to something invisible for his reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who is invisible. How did he see him who is invisible? Not with his eyes, but by his faith. He saw him in his mind. He saw him in his heart. He saw him in his intellect. And we see him who is invisible the same way. And so then in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, in the passage that was read to us at the beginning of the service, Paul is explaining something not only of how he's lived his life as a Christian, but how those he's writing to were living their lives as Christians. And at the very root, at the very center of how they lived, and then also what they hoped for, was faith, was seeing that which is invisible. He said, as he started chapter 4 of 2 Corinthians, that they've renounced secret and shameful ways, and that they have pursued the gospel, not only for themselves, but in preaching it to others. He's, of course, primarily describing his own ministry as an apostle, a disciple of Jesus. And he talks about how the God of this age has blinded the minds of unbelievers so they cannot see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ. And he says, we don't preach ourselves, but Christ as Lord and ourselves as servants. But he says, we have this treasure, this knowledge of the invisible and what he's doing and has done in jars of clay. Human bodies that are pretty frail, they get old. As Rodney said in his prayer this morning, we are starting to suffer the results of aging. That's what he's talking about here, these jars of clay. But it's more than just what we naturally suffer. Because they're preaching the gospel, they are actually being persecuted. He talked about being crushed, perplexed, persecuted. struck down, carrying around in our body, in effect, the death of Jesus. But he said in verse 13, it is written, I believed, therefore I have spoken. With that same spirit of faith, we also believe and therefore speak. He's talking about believing in that which is invisible. And he says in verse 16, then, therefore we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. We see Him who is invisible by our faith. And so we believe the God is there. We serve Him with dedication of heart and life by faith. He'll go on just shortly after this, I guess, in chapter 5 to talk about we walk by faith and not by sight. As we continue in the following weeks our study of the God who is there, we'll be looking at what's the basis of our faith. We realize that just because somebody believes something doesn't make it true. We don't have faith just for the sake of faith. We don't believe in something just to believe in something. Is there the evidence? Is there support sufficient to justify such faith? Certainly the atheist and the agnostic says no. We say yes. What's the evidence? When Jesus came declaring that He was the Son of God and come to die for the sins of men, He did not ask people to believe that without some evidence. In fact, He kept telling those who questioned Him, He said, believe because of the evidence. We also believe because of the evidence. And while we may share and ought to be sharing with our children, our grandchildren, others, that we believe God exists, we also ought to give them some inkling of the evidence that supports our faith. And we'll be moving forward in that.